Omaha Public Radio presents a special program on Noon Forum. We'll hear a debate between three of the four candidates for the office of United States Senator from Nebraska. The debate took place at the Nebraska State Fair in Lincoln and was sponsored by the Nebraska Farm Bureau. This program was recorded on Saturday, August 23, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The participants in the debate will be Republican Mike Johanns, Democrat Scott Klebb, and Green Stephen Larrick. They are vying for the office being vacated by Republican Chuck Hagel, who is not seeking another term in the United States Senate. The opinions expressed are those of the candidates and do not necessarily represent those of the Nebraska Farm Bureau, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Ken Rogers of the Rural Radio Network.
Good morning and welcome to the Nebraska State Fair. I'm Ken Rogers from the Rural Radio Network and welcome to this senatorial debate. We are pleased to be joined by three of the four candidates to represent Nebraska in the United States Senate. In alphabetical order, they are Republican Mike Johanns, Democrat Scott Klebb, and Green Party candidate Steve Larrick. Nebraska Party candidate Kelly Rosberg decided not to participate. We have a nice audience in this open-air auditorium, and you will hear from them at the end of this hour. I would like to introduce our panelists today who will be making and asking the questions of the candidates. They include Leslie Reed from the Omaha World Herald, John Vanderford from KOLN-KGIN Television in Lincoln, and Fred Knapp of NET Radio. The ground rules set up like this. The candidates will be asked a question. Each will have 90 seconds to answer. Then a 30-second opportunity to rebut those comments will be offered, or the next candidate up will have the option to ask for a new question, and so on. They will also be given 2 minutes for closing comments. Just over 1 hour ago, random drawings were held to determine the order of the questioning, the stage placement, as well as the order of closing comments. That's out of the way. Let's get on with the debate. We will start with Scott Klebb with the first question being asked by Fred Knapp of NET Radio.
The federal government recently projected a record budget deficit, and inflation at both the wholesale and retail level has reached a 27-year high. Do you believe that deficits and inflation are related? And if you as senator had to support unpopular measures to reduce the deficit, what taxes would you raise, or alternatively, what big ticket programs would you cut?
You know, you're right. And we all face now in this country a $9 trillion debt. And that when we have $9 trillion worth of debt, what that means is the things that we would like to invest in, like healthcare and education and reducing our dependency on foreign oil. All of these things that we want are being mortgaged because of that $9 trillion that we spent. Now, we used to have this right. We used to balance our budget. We used to operate in an appropriations process that meant that we should not be mortgaging our kids' future on our inability to make hard decisions right now. We need to return to pay-as-you-go spending, which means what we do in our family budgets every day, and that is not spend more money than we have. Now, we can do this. But we shouldn't be talking about new tax increases just yet, because what we need to do is talk about spending. There has been an incredible amount of spending in Washington right now, to the point where, as I said, we started in 2000 with about a $1 trillion debt, and we went the wrong direction. In 7.5 years, we've increased by $8 trillion in just the last few years. It's the wrong direction. Return to fiscal discipline, return to an appropriations process, and don't start talking about new taxes yet, because new taxes, especially at a time when high costs of energy and high costs of fuel and food prices continue to be an increasing burden on small businesses and families here in the state, what we should be saying is, you know, there are 2/3 of companies in our country right now, 2/3 of companies that are not paying their fair share of taxes, that aren't paying taxes at all. Let's start by going after the taxes that we know we are not collecting on. Let's start there first.
Thank you.
Before we talk about any more increases.
Thank you. Mike Johanns?
Well, I certainly know a lot about balancing budgets. When I became the mayor of Lincoln, the general fund literally was headed into the red. When I left 8 years later, we had turned that around. and literally left about $30 million behind in the general fund, maintained our AAA bond rating. As the governor, of course, I balanced the budget every year during some very, very difficult times, post 9/11. One of the things that you learn right from the start is this. As complicated as these budgets are, and they are enormously complex, what you begin to realize is that there's really two main factors that you look at, the economic base upon which you tax and the tax rate that is applied to that economic base. If you grow the tax base, then you can bring the rate down. As a mayor, I dropped the tax rate on property tax by about 30% because we were growing the economy. In 2007, while I was in the cabinet, we had the largest revenues in history. So my approach is this: grow the economy, pull back on spending, and good things are going to happen. And if you sustain that over a period of time, you will not only balance the budget, but much like I did as mayor, you can actually start to rebuild that. And that's where we need to be headed. Good quality jobs with benefits, pay taxes, that's where we need to be headed.
Thank you. Steve Larrick.
Hello, fellow Nebraskans. I think the hard decisions need to be made, and I'm ready to make them as your Senate candidate from Nebraska, from the Green Party. What we've found in recent years is military spending is totally out of control. Right now, the actual defense budget, along with the cost of the wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan, is and all the different new homeland security measures and all the different expenditures are over $1 trillion. And this is not a sustainable spending. What I saw in the newspaper a couple weeks ago in the New York Times, there was an article about the Ainsworth Wind Farm. And they interviewed an Iraq veteran Iraq War veteran. He was working on this Ainsworth Wind Farm. And he said, I would much rather be working on windmills here in Nebraska, creating energy from renewable wind sources, solar sources, than being over in Iraq fighting over oil. And I think it is time we redirect our nation's energies toward a renewable energy policy where we develop an entire series of actions, including education of our youth, to try to get people back into our rural communities in a renewable wind energy and solar energy economy.
All right, thank you very much. Now, as the format goes, Mr. Johans, you have the opportunity for rebuttal, or we can go to the next question.
Let's go to the next question.
Very good. That'll be asked by Leslie Reed of the Omaha World Herald.
Morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Speaking of renewable energy, I have a two-part question about ethanol. By many accounts, the U.S. ethanol program has been wildly successful. It's been a major boost to farmers in small towns in Nebraska. It's encouraged the use of renewable fuels and pushed up corn prices. But it's also been blamed for higher feed costs and for higher grocery bills. First, researchers now are working to develop ethanol that doesn't derive from corn. Do you believe corn-based ethanol must eventually be phased out? And second, do you support relief valves in the renewable fuel standard to aid livestock producers hard hit by higher feed prices?
Of course, I know quite a bit about ethanol. I was the governor that got a tax credit program put in place so we could build ethanol plants in our state. We went from virtually nowhere to the second largest producer in the nation, now producing over 1 billion gallons. Corn-based ethanol is not only a part of our present, but it will be a part of our future. I noticed in an article that I read that Scott talked about in Columbus, where he said, no, corn-based ethanol will not be a part of our future. I could not disagree more, and here's why. We've made a 25-year investment in ethanol. By some estimates, if ethanol did not exist, our gas prices would go up by as much as 20 to 25%. Corn-based ethanol is a part of our future. Now, having said that, there's also some very exciting things happening with cellulosic ethanol. That is positive. might be switchgrass, it might be corn cobs, whatever, but that is positive. Secondly, the relief valves. I was in the cabinet while we were debating whether relief valves should be a part of the law, and I insisted that they be there. Why? Because there may be a time where you need those relief valves, but you have to be very judicious about exercising them. Why? Because it sends a signal to the ethanol industry that maybe you're losing confidence, and that has a very negative impact on the marketplace and the corn grower.
Thank you. Mr. Larrick?
I think corn-based ethanol was a great transitional technology, but I think we shouldn't be expanding to the level that the current parties are suggesting. You know, we need to be more careful about our long-term water supply as well as the soil erosion that comes about through too much corn production. When I worked in the Nebraska Department of Economic Development in the early 1980s, and I was seeing some soil blow across the roads, and so I went and studied sustainable agriculture and sustainable development. And we need energy systems that get much more energy out of the process than you put in. And corn is so close to a one-to-one ratio. Earlier, there were many studies that showed that we actually had a net loss in energy with all the inputs in corn in terms of running the tractors, putting all the petrochemicals on the land. We were actually losing energy. After years and hundreds of millions of dollars of research, there's now a net gain of energy, but there are a lot of damaging effects of the soil and water resources. So we need to instead move to renewable energy where there's wind and solar are there all the time, and well, not all the time. That's one of the problems with wind. But if you have a mixed energy system where you have a net gain in energy like wind and solar, that is the future of rural Nebraska and rural America.
Thank you. Mr. Klebb?
The answer is ethanol has been a boom. It will be a boom. And no, we should not change the RFS standard. But I have to take issue with something that Mike said. You know, this is the way politics works. You say something enough, you hope people believe it. He knows that I've always been a supporter of ethanol, that ethanol has brought $1.4 billion into our economy. It is 2 million barrels a day, reducing our dependency on foreign oil. Ethanol is good. It's good for our country. It'll be good for our future. And the efficiency rates are increasing by 2% every year. That we can do more? Absolutely, we should be doing more. Which is why I don't know why, as Secretary of Agriculture, he urged the President to veto the Farm Bill, which included $1 billion of research for cellulosic ethanol. We have tremendous potential in this state, from corn-based ethanol, cellulosic ethanol. Wind power right here in our state could create 30,000 jobs. Iowa, our neighbor to the east, produces 18 times more wind power than we do. On the second question with regard to the we can do more, and in the next with regard to the renewable fuel standard, not weakening the renewable fuel standard, but doing more. And this is the listening tour that we had where we solicited ideas from everybody across the state. A great idea that I heard was somebody saying, why don't we have in the next Farm Bill a revenue-based approach, a revenue-based insurance plan for our livestock producers to help them in times of high volatility like we're dealing with right now. This can be a win-win for not only row crop agriculture, not only reducing our dependency on foreign oil, but also on our livestock producers.
Thank you. Mr. Larrick, would you like more rebuttal time or the next question?
More rebuttal time.
Okay, you have, go ahead.
Yes, I heard some mention by both candidates, I think, of cellulosic energy. The amazing thing, though, is that in 1980, Barry Commoner came to Nebraska, came to Lincoln as the presidential candidate in the third party that was then the Citizen Party. And he said within 5 years, if we invested in cellulosic energy research, we would have a good system. And the two parties that currently exist haven't done it over the last 30 years. I don't know when they will get to encouraging cellulosic ethanol.
Thank you. Mr. Klebb, 30 seconds.
The best thing that we can do is recognize that Nebraska's interest should be first and foremost for the next senator of the United States from the state of Nebraska, making sure that our number one industry in agriculture is not only that we're not only asking it to feed the world, which we've done, but increasingly fuel the world. What can we do for not only ethanol, not only our row crop agricultures, but what can we do to make sure that we have a vibrant system here for our livestock producers, too, which is why that revenue-based insurance program that I heard from producers across the state saying this would make a lot of sense. This would help us in times of volatility. That's where we should be going.
Mr. Johans, 30 seconds.
Very quickly, the exact quote was, corn-based ethanol is a part of our present. It will not be a part of our future. That's the exact quote from the Columbus newspaper from Scott. The important point, though, here, ladies and gentlemen, is this. The research that is going on in this area, both in terms of the corn plant and cellulosic ethanol, is exciting. We actually put more money than $1 billion into the Farm Bill for research into this area. Why? In 2 years, you're going to see a corn variety that will increase production by 40% on dry land, and you're going to see cellulosic plants come into production very quickly in the next 2 to 4 years.
Thank you. Next, we'll have the question for Steve Larrick, asked by John Vanderford of KOLN KGIN Television.
Good morning, candidates.
Good morning.
It was recently reported the estimated median size of Nebraska towns may be at its lowest ever. The median population in the state is now said to be 320 people. I grew up in a small town. We all love our small towns in Nebraska. What would you do as a Nebraska U.S. Senator to keep small towns active and alive?
Well, thanks, John. As I mentioned, I think green energy is the future of the state of Nebraska, and renewable energy that creates a great net gain of energy, and that's what we have in wind and solar. We need to have been investing in those technologies much greater than we have in the past, and that's the future. And what we need is actually our whole education system to be geared towards teaching our young people the science of renewable energy, where we can harvest the energy of the sun and the wind in perpetuity, and get our youth learning the science of renewable energy that so that they can be the inventors of the new energy systems of the 21st century. We're so locked into the old technologies, as even our own president says, we're addicted to oil, and yet somehow we keep wanting to drill off the coast of Florida and all along our coasts or in the Arctic wilderness. We have better solutions with renewable energy, and Europe is making great strides in developing a renewable energy system. And so that we need to move that way, and that's going to bring youth back to these small communities. We would have community energy grants where the community would decide what technology worked best in their situation, whether they have good wind or whether they have good solar, or even there are new breakthroughs in pond scum or whatever they call algae. There's great biofuels that can be created in algae, and that's a very renewable source. And so that is the future of our rural communities.
Thank you. Scott Klebb?
You know, Steve is right that our small towns can benefit tremendously from alternative energy production. There's a man up in Lyons, Nebraska, showing that real entrepreneurial spirit on this energy equation by investing in wind and investing in biodiesel and investing in all sorts of new fuels and really giving renewed life to the town of Lyons. And we should do everything we can to support that. Renewable fuels alone, if you look to wind power in our state, we have the sixth greatest potential, and yet we produce less than, I mean, Iowa, our next-door neighbor, produces 18 times more. Why is that? Because we've had failed leadership actually moving this agenda forward, making sure that we keep our state and our interests first and foremost on our politicians' mind is of critical importance at this time. But there's more that we can do beyond just renewable energy. It holds great promise, but we should also be talking about the new Homestead Act, which encourages young families to come out, encouraging our veterans to come out and actually start a new home, investing in their future, building broadband technologies across our state so that entrepreneurs like the man up in Lyons, Nebraska, can actually do more with what he's doing. That we need to make sure that the next senator from the United States from Nebraska will always keep Nebraska's interests first. And that means not quitting on the job. It troubles me that our number one industry is agriculture and that our farmers and ranchers didn't even get a two-week notice before the secretary quit on them.
Thank you, Mr. Johans.
Let me, if I might, just focus very, very clearly on the components here. A good ag economy makes for a good, strong economy on Main Street. Let me draw some comparisons, if I could. When I became Secretary of Agriculture, wheat prices were about $3.50 a bushel. Today, they're in the vicinity of $9. Corn prices hovered around $1.95, actually dropped to about $1.60 during Katrina. Had been that way forever. Today, I can tell you that corn prices are in the $6 range. soybean prices. When I became Secretary of Agriculture, soybean prices were about $5.50. Today, they're in the vicinity of $13.50. What does that mean for small-town Nebraska? All of a sudden, you have some dollars in the economy. And I could go through the other commodities across the country. Build the rural economy. But the second thing is focus on your small towns. We did it as a governor. I did it as a secretary. We have a plan out there that says, look, we will incent businesses to invest in capital equipment. We'll allow them to expense that on their tax return. We have a plan that says high-speed internet is what we need to do. Invest in our community colleges, which we did when I was the governor. Critical access health care, our critical access hospitals, are so important to the success of our small towns. And then finally, in the Farm Bill proposal I had, we invested in sewer and water to the tune of about $500 million plus. Why? Because it's important for that community to grow.
Thank you. Mr. Clabb, would you like rebuttal time for the next question?
Take the next question.
Next question, okay. We will go on. Fred Knapp, you will ask the fourth question to Scott Clabb.
Several reasons have been offered for the war in Iraq, including countering the threat posed by supposed weapons of mass destruction and building a democracy as an alternative to a despotic regime that bred despair and violence in the Middle East. If you were in the Senate, what would be a powerful enough reason for you to support another preemptive war? And conversely, what reason that might sound good would not be sufficient for you?
Well, first and foremost, it's the security of the American people, that we will take any action necessary to keep America secure and keep America strong in the world going forward. That is the first and foremost responsibility of the United States Senate and any senator holding this job. That being said, I also think that we shouldn't use war as the first example, or war as the first means by which we can actually make gains for American security abroad. Now, when we're looking forward, looking back at the mistakes of the past, was part of the problem was that we were too willing to look at war first as the first and foremost thing that we should have done. Now, there's good developments right now by using regional allies, having the security of Iraq become first and foremost on the minds of the Iraqis themselves, and even the president himself has signaled that ultimately the future of Iraq is in the hands of the Iraqis. That's the first and foremost concern that he's always had. Recently, just as a couple of days ago, they signaled that ultimately we will begin to draw our soldiers out and return sovereign to the Iraqi people. Looking forward, we have tremendous potential to actually use diplomacy in ways that even Ronald Reagan used, which we have forgotten now and the current administration has forgotten. And that is, just because you're talking to somebody does not mean that you disagree with them. We have real reasons to talk to Iran about their support for Hamas and Hezbollah, and why are you doing this? Real reasons to talk to Iran about their nuclear program. And that does not mean that we agree with them, but it does mean that we can use leverage points on a situation like Iran for American aims in moving forward. But that is going to take an entirely different approach than we've had before, which is a go-it-alone approach.
Thank you. Mike Johans?
The focus, of course, must be on national security. That's what you're looking at. That's what you're trying to determine in terms of what is at risk. Secondly, and very, very importantly, you have to pay attention to our allies around the world. Our allies at times find themselves in very, very difficult and unfair positions. Georgia is the most recent example. Russia just simply moves the tank in. 1960s-style Soviet Union. We need to stand up with Georgia. And I'm not suggesting military action, but the aid that we have provided to them is enormously important. So supporting our allies is critical as you analyze this. The third area, ladies and gentlemen, we are fighting a war on terror. We tend to look at 9/11 and say, well, that was a long time ago. We've been safe since then. But I will point out to you that the world has not been safe. We've had terrorist attacks throughout the world since 9/11. We have to be ever mindful that we have to protect you and the national security. And so focusing on the war on terror is enormously important. And then the final point I want to make, because it's appropriate in this vein, and again, we have a disagreement about this, we should never negotiate with rogue nations without preconditions. You squander the prestige and the power of the American presidency when you do that.
Thank you. Mr. Steve Larrick?
I guess I disagree quite a bit with the approaches that I've heard. I think that we need to scale down the dialogue of anger towards the rest of the world. I think that the invasion of Iraq was based on false premises. And, you know, we were again told that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, even when our own intelligence people were telling us that they didn't. And so we were also told that there were strong links between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. Again, that was proven wrong. We have been misled into a war that is now costing us $3 billion a week. And the longer we stay, the more blood will be shed. It is time to respect the sovereignty of the Iraqi people. They want us out very soon, and they're looking for us to move on. But I don't think we should move, responding to the question, I don't think we should be looking, what war can we go into next? Iran has been shown by our own national intelligence estimate, 16 different intelligence agencies within the U.S. government said that Iran gave up their weapons program in 2003. Just May 26th in 2008, this year, the international weapons inspectors from the United Nations said that Iran is complying with their requests in terms of their handling of nuclear materials. We need to scale down okay, my time is up.
Thank you. You have to finish your thought, but that's okay. Okay, Mr. Johans, do you want more rebuttal time or next question?
Next question.
It will be asked by Leslie Reed in the Omaha World Herald. It will go to you, Mr. Johans.
Many American workers feel undercut by the presence of illegal immigrants who often accept lower wages for difficult and dangerous labor. Those immigrants, in turn, are vulnerable to exploitation by unscrupulous employers. If you support securing the borders to reduce illegal immigration, how will you respond to the 12 million people who have moved here without following legal procedures? Should there be a limited amnesty program?
I'll just answer that very, very succinctly and directly, no. And here's why. I have an amnesty plan out there that's very straightforward. It's tough, but it's fair. And here's what this amnesty program says. Or this immigration program, rather, says. It says, number one, no amnesty. It says, number two, secure the borders. Number three, workplace enforcement. Number four, very, very clearly, if you are here illegally, you have to return home, and you have to enter this country legally, no jumping to the front of the line. And then the final piece of this is that if you have violated the law while you are here, you have given up your right to come back here and try to re-enter the country legally. Again, I think it's a plan that is understandable, it's fair. Here's the point about this whole issue here. We Americans just fundamentally believe that you have to follow the rules. And if you're not following the rules, you should not get a benefit from that. So no amnesty. My plan is clear. It just fundamentally says tough but fair. If you are here illegally, you have to return. And no jumping in line. You have to re-enter this country legally.
Thank you. Mr. Lerick?
I think that an amnesty program could be workable, but because so many of the businesses have gone down to Latin America and invited workers to come and work in the factories. And then they come into the communities, and they are a vital part of communities, reviving rural communities, becoming members of the local churches, sending their, having their kids in schools. And they become a part of the community. And then all of a sudden, when these raids come in and families get ripped apart, now they're making it a felony just to be in this country. And so there are actually, in the Postville situation, the terrible situation in Iowa, there are people who just are hardworking people with families are being put in prisons, and they're felons now. And to me, this is so inhumane. And I think, there's a need to protect our borders. But then why are people coming here? I think we need a fairer trade policies with third world countries. So many farmers in Mexico and throughout Latin America are being starved by many of our NAFTAs and CAFTAs, all these free trade agreements that big corporations get big profits on, and the working people on the farms keep getting shortchanged, and their families are hungry. So they come to this land for economic opportunity, like so many of the people in this room. All of our ancestors came to looking for economic opportunity. So we need to figure out more humane ways of doing this.
Thank you. Mr. Kleb?
No, I don't believe in amnesty for anybody who breaks the law, individuals or businesses. And I think we do need to make sure that this is something that we talk very seriously about, because it's not just about immigration. It's also about national security. Because if we can smuggle people in, who knows what else we can smuggle in. So this is a national security item, and that's why I've been very clear throughout that I do not support amnesty for either individuals or for employees or employers who hire people knowingly, knowing that they are actually illegal. But, you know, I'm not actually sure. I haven't changed on this position. This is who I've been for a long time. And it seems as though, as governor, my opponent, Mr. Johans, didn't actually go after one employer for illegally hiring people. And then as Secretary of Agriculture actually advocated for the president's plan. Now that he's running for this particular job, he changes his position on this and is much tougher than he has ever been before. We need consistency. We need to make sure that the people that we send have true values that are not going to change depending on which job they hold or what the polls are saying at that particular time. We need to be tough on those who break the law, to include employers who knowingly hire people illegally. We've got to be consistent. We've got to make sure that we have the real changes that we all know have to happen, that they've got to be reflected in the people that we send to Washington. Not changing on policies, but true changes to bring our values to Washington, because that's how we're going to change Washington.
Thank you. Mr. Larrick, would you like a rebuttal time or the next question?
Next question.
The next question will come from John Vanderford, and it will be asked of Mr. Larrick.
Although corn prices have shown promise this year for many farmers, producers are still struggling in some other areas. If elected, what would you do to open up more trade opportunities with other countries that would directly benefit Nebraska's agricultural industry?
Thank you, John. One of the things that's come up in recent years is that Asian countries are rejecting our beef. Why is that? What is happening is that in our beef industry, we are speeding up line speed to where the workers are working so hard, they have difficulties in keeping up quality, and they're getting injured on the job, and things are getting sloppier and sloppier. We need to better regulate the meat industry so that we can assure the quality of our meat in foreign markets. You know, the Koreans don't like, you know, bits of pieces of other things in their foods, and so they are rejecting this, and this is hurting our farmers. We need to have good USDA inspections to assure the quality of our foods. Australia and New Zealand, they take better care of their animals, and they keep a cleaner environment in the meatpacking plants, and they are selling their products very easily in Asia. But again, we are cutting corners to increase profits for big mega industrial corporations that are making the profits, and we need to better protect the farmers with quality products for export.
Thank you. Mr. Kleb?
Trade is good, and we should trade. We should trade more, because we're not only trading commodities, we're not only trading goods, we're not only trading services, but we're also trading values, and we need to do that more. But unfortunately, we have not. We've been putting our farmers and ranchers, who, by the way, have done more than their share to keeping our trade deficit in balance. They've done more than their fair share of that. But we've been putting our producers here at a disadvantage to producers overseas by not having fair trade. If we're going to hold our industries, including agriculture, at one standard on environmental or on labor standards here, then we should also hold our trading partners to the same to the same high regard, because that is putting our industries at a disadvantage. But trade going forward is something that we do need to get much tougher about, because we've gone the wrong direction. If you look at just one company or just one country in particular, China, a few years ago we had a trade deficit with China of about $50 billion. Now we have a trade deficit with China over $280 billion. This is going the wrong direction. And it's going the wrong direction because we are not doing enough to make sure that we can actually compete on a level playing field. We are putting our industries here in Nebraska at a disadvantage. And as the next United States Senator has always got to keep our interests first and foremost on their agenda. Our interests, Nebraska's interests. And we can continue to move to expand trading opportunities, keeping our single most important industry strong and vibrant, because it does so much more than simply trade goods.
Thank you. Mr. Johans.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me, if I might, bring some accuracy and precision to this debate. First thing I want to tell you is that, Governor, I was specifically asked, do you support amnesty? I said no. That's on the record. I think, Scott, you know it's on the record. The second thing I want to say, I was asked that same question as a member of the cabinet. Do you support amnesty? I said no. Scott, I'd be very, very careful. I've read your plan. You say no amnesty, but when you say, I want a few more fines and penalties, and that clears things up, that is going to be regarded as amnesty. I don't care how you slice it or dice it, it's going to be regarded as amnesty. The other area of just complete inaccuracy is this. If you look at the trade numbers for agriculture over the past 4 years, every single year that I was Secretary of Agriculture, we set a new record. This year, it is projected that trade will go over $100 billion. We're selling our ag products overseas. Trade is very important to agriculture. 25% of the income for farmers and ranchers in this nation comes from trade. Now, finally, let me clear up China. Yes, there's a big trade deficit. If you study the trade deficit for agriculture, we're winning. We sell more agricultural products to China than they sell to us, and that's only going to grow if we stay on a path of opening up markets and leveling the playing field, which is exactly what I did as Secretary.
Thank you. Mr. Klebb, would you like rebuttal time?
I will take a rebuttal.
Yes.
I didn't say amnesty. I said that as Secretary, or excuse me, as Governor, you didn't actually go after any people who knowingly hired knowingly hired illegal immigrants. That's all I said. Now, with regard to trade, we can do better, and I said that trade has actually done good, and that Nebraska's agriculture and agriculture in general has done more than its fair share, but we are still harming our industries here in Nebraska. Plants like DeWitt, Nebraska, that are now having to shut down their doors as a result of our trade policies with regard to countries like China. We can do more to strengthen trade, and we should, and we haven't.
Okay. Mr. Johans?
Scott, I appreciate you clarifying that. Quite honestly, I understood you to say that I was out there supporting amnesty. I do not, and I never have. Important point here, ladies and gentlemen, trade is terribly important. Trade Promotion Authority has expired. I don't care who's in the White House. President could be a Democrat, a Republican. It doesn't matter. We need to give them trade promotion authority, or we will have no trade agenda whatsoever in the years to come.
Thank you, Mr. Larrick.
I'd just like to reiterate that we do need quality products in our export. And when you eliminate government jobs of doing the job of protecting the quality of our food, and you know, we have more imports coming in with leaded toys that our children are putting in their mouths, we are being hurt. The quality of life in this country is being deteriorated if we don't have quality government. And so I think the whole bashing of government is a very sad thing. And when we feel that war is the only way that government can work in the world and that everything else is being cut, that's not right.
All right. Thank you very much. Our next question will be from Fred Knapp of NET Radio, going to Scott Klebb.
Congress recently granted telecommunications companies retroactive immunity for giving the government phone records of Americans without court approval in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks. Do you think the companies should have been excused for this, and what expectation of privacy, if any, do you think American citizens should have for their communications?
Let's be very clear with what happened here, and that is that companies, knowing that they were breaking the law, we had to decide whether or not to let them break the law. I don't believe in amnesty at all. I don't believe in amnesty on this issue. I don't believe in amnesty on illegal immigrants. I don't believe in amnesty for employers who knowingly hire illegal immigrants. I don't believe in amnesty. We are a nation of laws, and we need to respect the laws of this country. That being said, of course, our single most important interest is keeping the American people secure and safe, and knowing that we can actually go after terrorists, whether they're listening to us or whatnot, but that is not what happened here. These are companies who knowingly broke the law, and we are supposed to let them get away with it. That's not right. That's not who this country is. When we put our hand on the Constitution of the United States and swear to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States and the people here, we do two things. One, keeping America secure, but also making sure that those liberties which we know and cherish and makes us unique and special in this world, that we will defend both of those. Knowingly giving amnesty to companies who broke the law is not right. We can reform FISA. We can make sure that we can actually go after electronically or any other way the people who are threatening us, and we do need to make sure that we keep those security strong. But letting people break the law is just not who we are.
Thank you. Mr. Johans?
Ladies and gentlemen, government works best, I think, when there's absolute full disclosure and you deal with people very, very directly. Fred knows this when he asked the question. My spouse actually works in this industry, and I want you to know that. She worked for Lincoln Telephone, and then I'll tell. But having said that, I want to point out something here that's very important. Scott has made a huge assumption here. Scott has made an assumption that these companies knew that they were violating the law and just said, what the heck? I'll just knowingly expose myself to lawsuits and litigation and whatever else comes down to violate the law. And you know what? It didn't happen that way. This was post-9/11. The world was frightened by what had happened. We were trying to figure out what had happened. And the United States government went to these companies and said, look, this is the way it's going to be. And you know what? They had very, very little choice. So as this debate occurred and as information came out about really what was happening, you ended up with a bipartisan bill. Democrats, Republicans supporting this bill. In fact, somebody correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think I am. I think even Barack Obama ultimately said he would vote for this bill. That's what this should be about, is a debate that gets all the facts and information out. And when that occurred, you had a situation where this bill passed with tremendous bipartisan support.
Thank you. Mr. Larrick?
I think, Mike, you hit a nail right on the head. These companies did break the law, but they were asked by the president and the vice president to break the law, to abandon the constitutional rights that the American people have. I think that's, you know, that says it right there. And I am a great defender in human rights, in our constitutional rights. I think we need to restore the Constitution. So many of our rights are being eliminated left and right in the name of terrorists or after us. We need to protect our constitutional rights before they're gone. And they are literally being pulled out from under our feet as we speak. You know, I think we need to go to the top. I mean, we can't be abandoning the Constitution because that's our rules, and that we need to stand by those. And so, I think that we should have been tougher on the companies who went along with breaking the Constitution. But then I think that the leadership in this country needs to change so that we have a government that is of the people, for the people, and by the people. And that's what the Green Party is trying to bring about. We don't have 60% or more of our funding for our campaign coming from out of state. I worked my life in community development in Nebraska, in small towns and inner city neighborhoods, trying to help the low-income communities across our state and to build opportunities for people to have a healthy community. And I see much of this being stripped away.
Thank you. Mr. Johans, would you like rebuttal time?
No more. No rebuttal.
All right.
Next question.
Next question will come from Leslie Reed, Omaha World Herald, to Mr. Johans.
Hello. If it's not a drought, it's a flood. The 2008 Farm Bill has provided for a permanent disaster relief program instead of the ad hoc system of the past. Do you endorse permanent disaster relief?
I certainly support disaster relief, but here's the problem with what was in the Farm Bill. And incidentally, let me again just make sure everybody knows that my position was we needed a Farm Bill. I indicated I would vote for this Farm Bill, but here's the issue that you face here. The proposal we made was based upon what farmers told us across the country in our listening sessions. They said over and over again, Mike, depending upon what I purchase, I can insure 50 to 80% of my loss. On the other hand, I have a situation where if I insure to that level, I'm completely exposed for the rest. Now, some farmers said to us, look, I won't like that, but I can withstand it. Other farmers, young farmers especially, said, look, we need something that will fill that gap and allow me to provide 100% of the coverage. I thought that was very, very thoughtful advice to us, so we had gap insurance in the program. They've ended up with a plan that's going to, if you qualify, and it's very, very hard to qualify under this Farm Bill plan, if you qualify, you may be able to boost your coverage by about 10%. That's the rule of thumb. Well, why not let a farmer, especially a young farmer, insure 100% of their loss? You know what? They didn't do that. They took the gap coverage out. And I think that was the wrong approach. But we'll keep working on this. We need to get farmers a better safety net here.
Thank you. Mr. Larrick?
Yes, on insurance, disaster relief for the farmers, I'm 100% for that. And the greatest relief we can do, though, is to deal with the problem of catastrophic climate change. We saw what happened with Katrina and more droughts around the world. We see the polar ice caps melting and falling into the sea and raising sea levels. The major insurance companies are kicking up the price of insurance because they know disasters are coming unless we do something about global warming. And this is something that we need, the scientists from around the world agree on this. And the only people that are saying no are the ExxonMobil corporations that are saying, we want to sell a lot more oil at these inflated prices so global warming doesn't exist. So they will hire these scientists that will say things that are patently false. And to get people to think that global climate change isn't real. But it is real, and the sooner we begin to deal with it on a serious basis, the better will it be for the environment and the less it will cost in the long term. If we wait until, you know, the science is in, it's just like the cancer. We wouldn't ban cigarettes until enough people died. The climate change, once it reaches a certain point, there's no turning back. We need to turn the corner on global climate change, or else we're in big trouble here in the Midwest. It will be a drought city.
Thank you. Mr. Kleb?
Yes, I do support permanent disaster relief. Drought relief, our farmers and ranchers here in the state have been dealing with the drought for over 10 years. And as you said, farmers around this country are dealing with floods or anything else. Let's be clear about what happened with the Farm Bill, though. Because the 2008 Farm Bill, when we were starting to talk about this bill in 2007, there was a proposal by the Secretary at that time from the President that didn't include disaster relief. It also would have increased crop insurance costs. It also didn't give country of origin labeling, something else that our farmers and ranchers have been calling for, that consumers have been calling for. And then when it didn't get any support from Republicans or Democrats in the House, and there was a compromise bill between Democrats and Republicans working to make sure that we have a strong safety network, having drought relief, having country of origin labeling, and all the things that were good in the Farm Bill, beginning the reform process, cutting back direct payments, but actually increasing the safety net for payments for farmers and ranchers. As Secretary, he urged the President to veto this important piece of legislation. Agriculture is being asked to not just feed our nation, but fuel our nation. It is the number one industry here in Nebraska, and the next senator has always got to keep Nebraska's interests first and foremost. It is our number one industry. We need to make sure that it's strong and robust because we are asking of it so much more to feed and fuel our country going forward, but that is going to take new leadership that doesn't say veto or that changes their mind when they decide to run for a new office.
Thank you. Mr. Larrick, will you act 30-second rebuttal?
I'm fine. Next
okay.
question.
Okay, with that being said, we are now at the appointed time where that is the end of questions. We will now go to closing remarks of the three candidates. Also, before today's debate, a random drawing was held, and we will first start with the two-minute closing remarks from Scott Klebb.
Thank you. And thank you all for participating and having me participate in one of the oldest and most respected forms of discussion in our politics and in our country. We're here because debates matter. Contests between ideas matter. We know that government can be a powerful tool in changing people's lives. We saw that first with the Homestead Act that opened up these lands for the first generation of pioneers. We saw that when Franklin Roosevelt and George Norris came together to bring electricity to my grandparents' farmstead. We know that government is a powerful tool, but it is just a tool. It can either help or hurt, and it makes a difference what type of leaders we have. We know that we need now, more than any time before in our recent past, we need leaders who will stop looking to the next election or the next job and start thinking about the next generation. We know what that looks like. We know what that means. It means having an ability to reach across the aisle, bring Democrats and Republicans together, and not simply toe a party line. It means having a budget that reflects our priorities, like investing in health care, investing in education, and investing in family farms and agriculture here in the state of Nebraska, not wasteful spending. It means that we need real leaders in Washington, real leaders who will say something, not just because the polls say it's right, but because they feel it is right at that time. Real leaders who will not just toe the party line, but will do what's right for Nebraska. Always put Nebraska first, and this is the most important thing. We'll never quit until the job is done. We know that we in here in Nebraska don't quit. We've got big challenges ahead of us, tremendous challenges, but by working hard, working smart, and working together, each and every one of us can overcome those challenges like we have in the past. But that is going to have to take a change. That is going to have to take new leadership that puts Nebraska first and never stops. Thank you for being a part of this discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Larrick. 2 minutes.
I thank you all for coming today and showing an interest in the political system. I think it's really exciting to have an opportunity, and I want to thank the Farm Bureau for allowing me to be here to speak. I think it's a very important message that I bring to you today, that war is not the answer. And our country right now, with the two-party system currently, is saying, what war next? Do we invade Iran? Do we start bombing in Venezuela? They have a lot of oil. We need to back off. We need to begin to build a world of peace. Look at what happened in Europe. Those countries fought like heck for generations, but now the European Union is uniting, and they don't even think about invading each other now and within the European Union. We need to broaden that union to all the people, the global community, and not be thinking in terms of, you know, again, what war is next. We can, every time we attack some country in the name of terrorists, we create two more enemies for every terrorist we kill. We need to back off that and begin to work for the basic principles of the Green Party: peace, environmental health, social justice, and true grassroots democracy. And my career is in working with communities across this state in the Nebraska Community Improvement Program and the Urban Community Improvement Program, where I worked with Stephanie trying to help communities build a better future for their people. And I think if we begin to invest in the renewable potential of our wind and solar, we can bring a whole new generation of youth into solving the challenges that we face, and that we can actually improve the environment while we're building a stronger economy. And we can divert this $1 trillion a year spending on war toward a more healthy and peaceful future for our children and generations to come.
Thank you. Mike Johans, you have 2 minutes.
Let me, if I might start out, every once in a while during this debate, I've waved at someone out in the audience. Our granddaughter is here, and she waves at me, and I wave back. Ladies and gentlemen, a couple of things I want to do. First, again, in the interest of accuracy, I advised the President of the United States as a cabinet member when the House version of the bill came out to veto that bill. And you know why? Because for the first time since 1933, it included a tax increase, not just a tax increase on a separate industry. The policy of that, ladies and gentlemen, is that all of a sudden we throw open the door, so every farm bill that gets passed in the future, you have to figure out what tax increase you can live with. And you know what? That's the wrong policy. And I would do it again. You put a tax increase in a farm bill, and I will veto it, just like I vetoed the state budget when they boxed it up with tax increases. The second thing I will tell you, and I wish we had had a rebuttal on this, one of the last questions on climate change. Climate change, folks, is a defining issue in this campaign. I believe that we need more science in this area. There is a significant debate as to what role man plays in warming of the climate. We need to satisfy that debate. But here's the important point. Steve, in a document that I just picked up yesterday, says we've got to tax emissions, greenhouse emissions. Scott says we need to go further than Warner Lieberman, which collapsed on the Senate floor. An EPA study would indicate that Warner Lieberman would increase the price of gasoline 53 cents and more in the out years. Nebraskans need relief, not 53 cents higher in gasoline prices. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You have been listening to a live broadcast of the U.S. Senate debate for Nebraska, live from the Nebraska State Fair. I want to thank our panelists, Fred Knapp of NET Radio, Leslie Reed from the Omaha World Herald, and John Vanderford from KOLN KGIN Television in Lincoln. Also, thanks to the Nebraska Farm Bureau and the Rural Radio Network for their support of this important public affairs program. Our audience has been waiting very patiently, pretty much, for the last hour, and now is your opportunity, audience, to be heard, to support your candidates, Steve Larrick of the Green Party, Democrat Scott Klebb, and Republican Mike Johans. The general election will be held on November the 4th. Ladies and gentlemen, honor a veteran and vote. From the Nebraska State Fair, I'm Ken Rogers. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
've been listening to a special program on Noon Forum. We have heard a debate between three of the four candidates for the office of United States Senator from Nebraska. The participants in the debate were Republican Mike Johans, Democrat Scott Klebb, and Green Stephen Larrick. Nebraska Kelly Rosberg decided not to participate. They are all vying for the office being vacated by Republican Chuck Hagel, who is not seeking another term in the United States Senate. The debate took place at the Nebraska State Fair in Lincoln and was sponsored by the Nebraska Farm Bureau. This program was recorded on Saturday, August 23, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Martin Wells of NET Radio for providing the recording of this program. Now this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.